This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 155, The Jeffrey Combs of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Larry Nemechek. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including a recap of the Geek Nation Tour's trek to Las Vegas, a Geeky Award for Star Trek Continues, Axanar's shattering Kickstarter, and the prospects for DS9 and Voyager on Blu-ray. Then in the feature, we're joined by George Pappy for a special discussion about Susan Oliver and the Green Girl. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Larry. It's great to have you back here on the Ready Room with me and a co-host this time because you've got all the time in the world now, right? You're con, everything in a row, tour, everything is over now, and you're just relaxing back home in Los Angeles.
I started calling it the con tour sandwich because the two big cons were squeezing out the tour in the middle, and I felt squeezed out. And now I'm off my deathbed because I got back and had con crud that turned into my little custom sinus flu thing I get. So that was slow.
So how's life with all this free time now?
Yeah, free time. I feel like I'm free to get sick again or something. Free. Like I'm catching up. Like, hey, for the first time this year, I got my day. All these wonderful people who have been signing on for a long time when I have no Wi-Fi at conventions, people manually sign up for my newsletter, my once a month email from Trekland. So it's all good. I even went exploring today with our friend John Champion. We were doing some short-lived research. So,
well, one of these things that you've been busy with, of course, is Geek Nation Tours, and you guys made your trek from Los Angeles over to the convention in Las Vegas. And I wanted to hear firsthand from you, and I know the listeners do as well, what happened on the tour. You know, what was it like? Any great stories from the tour? Anything unexpected happen?
Well, I mean, for one thing, for me personally, I had to, the way the calendar fell, this is what I was talking about. We had Comic-Con and Vegas Trek were successive weekends. There was no gap in between, which was absolutely insane. And I was bitching about it online for like every 3 or 4 days I would say, whoever let this happen will never be allowed to, you know, or something. Because like it was like seeing the train wreck coming. And it wasn't just that the cons were a week apart. It's like we had the tour in between. And I already knew that I was going to leave Comic-Con Saturday morning, come back up to L.A., and we had our welcome dinner on Saturday afternoon. So anyway, and on one hand, it was kind of bittersweet because after the first tour 2 years ago, we wanted to have our welcome dinner at Siroc Lofton's restaurant. And it was kind of sad to find out about 2-3 months ago that it apparently had closed. And I was like, oh, no.
Oh, really? Oh,
no. And I was trying to get back in touch with him, and all the numbers and contacts I had for him had gone. And I did get to Aaron Eisenberg, and he said, no, I think they're just moving.
But yeah, I think I want to say Anthony Montgomery tweeted a picture of himself with Siroc in the restaurant a few weeks ago.
Well, I missed that picture, but I did catch up with Siroc in Vegas, and he said yes, we just reopened. I'd heard he had an issue with his old landlord, and he was looking for a new location. They'd gotten it. It was just too late for us to take our welcome dinner people there. Actually, they had opened on Monday, the last night we were in L.A., but I wouldn't have wanted to do that to anybody on their first night open to take, hey, let's take 15 people in on your first night open at your restaurant.
Well, the restaurant is called Sarah's, right? Now, were the old landlords, were they the paw wraiths and they didn't want her around? Is that what happened?
Wow, you went there. You went there, Chris. Yeah, that's exactly what it was. And then they accused Siroc of stealing from the Bajoran monks and it just went downhill from there. Yeah. But then we all had some June Justics. Everything was fine. We all laughed and laughed at the end. So it was great to find out that they were doing well. They just needed to move. And so hopefully we'll get time. But, you know, this year, the tour, we kept the best. We had some things. The first time we did the tour, the Tillman Water Plant, which is everybody's iconic, you know, the slanty roof building with the Boothby Gardens out in front. That was closed for reconstruction, some remodeling. So we couldn't take everybody there 2 years ago. So we got to go there this time and people took their photos. And I know there's photos up at the, I haven't done my posting. Somehow I was delayed coming out of Vegas somehow. I haven't done my blog and picture posting yet, but I know the Facebook for Geek Nation Tours has an album. People put their pictures there, but we did some of the same things we did before, which the big change, and we've talked about it. I feel like I've talked about it, but was going out to Valley of Fire.
Right.
The day before the con, we left LA a day early. We still got to Vasquez. We had Bobby Clark, talking about shooting Arena. What was cool this time was I had done some more research and found some other people. And we not only got up and had Bobby there talking about shooting Arena, but we knew the Rocks to go over to where they shot Friday's Child, you know, which is one of my most underappreciated Trek shows ever. And we lined up all the locations from where, you know, the I'm a Doctor, Not an Escalator line was, and Uchi Guchi Kuchi Koo. And most of all, putting the communicators down that caused the big rock slide, you know, that knocked all the carpet-toting Capella Four warriors to their knees. You know, the big rock slide, they put their communicators on sonic vibrate killer mode.
And, which you can do these days with iPhones, right? Just put them on vibrate and have the director call. Yeah.
That's right. Although I hear that that the CBS's licensees are coming out with now a communicator that can not only control your TV but can bring down a boulder slide on top of your enemies. It's
needed
does
feature.
The phaser one better. Yeah. So anyway, so we had a lot of it was just like the first tour was great, but we had about the same amount of people. But about half of the tour was Aussies and Brits. And the guys really got into it, and Jersey people. And then we had a mother and her son from L.A. Mm-hmm. And Chris was great. He listens to John and Ken's show, the Mission Log Pod. And we were on our final approach into Vegas, and he got me and he said, we were on the bus, and he said, Larry, do you think you might be able to introduce me to John Champion? And I said, Chris, I bet I could even probably introduce you to John and Ken both. And he was like, oh. So the night we had our landing, John and Mary Chawinski and I co-host a landing party, preview night party on Wednesday night at the only decent bar that's left open, as I had a rant on Facebook about leaving the Irish pub place open. Mm-hmm. Because it's great, except that it just ruins your throat within an hour.
I think you had a rant on the show here about that once, or
I hope so.
At least you and I have talked about it. If it wasn't on the show, yeah.
Maybe it was on the other side of the room.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that night I said, Chris says, Larry, is that John? I said, yes. So I went over to John and I said, John, one of your biggest fans is here. And he was on our tour. And he said, oh, well, let me go get Ken. And I said, okay. So I told Chris, and he came back, and it wasn't just John and Ken, but he had Rod with him too. Chris got to meet. So that was that, you know, he's 17 and that was a huge, huge thing for him. But the cool thing about the tour group, other thing was the shirts were, well, I just think they were cooler looking. They had a better graphic. My name was bigger. You could read it on the back. And people wore their shirts all over the place. And when they were in the con spaces or out, it was just really cool to see it pop up. And I know Terrace, it's his company. We were just really thrilled and happy. But bottom line here, the big point of the whole week was a surprise that we didn't even know about until about 2-3 months ago when we were planning the Valley of Fire, and we didn't leave at 8 a.m. We left at 7 a.m. from Vegas because we wanted to get there before it got so hot. And they said, oh no, you want to leave at 7 a.m. It's an hour here and it'll be 100 by 11. And you want to, you know, because they said that we were all about the shooting site, which is called Silica Dome, you know, the whole the Terran and the rocket launcher. And so, yeah, from Generations, the Killer Kirk Bridge and site and all that. And Mike Westmore was going to try to go with us, but Face Off claimed him, so he didn't get to go. And we hope in 2 years that I wish all the best for Face Off, but I wish they would back off the week before Vegas. So I was handling it all myself, and I'd done research and I had the production sketches. But when we were talking to the park people, they said, oh, and you are going to go to the bridge, right? And I said, what do you mean go to the bridge? And I'm thinking, you know, like helm and navigation and captain's chair. And she says, you know, we have the bridge from Generations. And I go, what do you mean the bridge? I go, wait, what? The killer bridge? And she laughs. She goes, yes. The shooting company, the movie company, when they finished filming and they had to take down the metal because they had ladders and, you know, it was a big pain. Mike Westbrook mm-hmm. talks about that in my companion book. And someday we'll get that on a Trekline speaker. But he's talking about how crazy it was. And by the time they shot the grave scene, it was just very small skeleton crew. It was just Patrick and the Rocks and a grip or a prop guy. And then the cameraman and David Carson, the director, and Michael to do Patrick's makeup. And that was all there was kind of left to do that scene. And so it was hard to get up and down the ladders. That was a major pain. And it was kind of, you know, out of the way. So I said, what do you, so when they were finished shooting, they had to haul everything out. And one of the bridges, the one that they used for the final thing, was intact. And Paramount gave the bridge to the park because it was structurally sound enough to use. And the park said, yes, we can use it. It's not near there. It's in a totally other different part of the park. But they had a creek okay. with a trail, and they put this bridge up over the trail. And no one, I mean, it's, they shot the movie 20 years ago.
Right.
You know, they gave it to the park right out. I guess it sat there for 20 years and it's in the heat, but, you know, desert things don't rust. So right. it's been there for forever. And I was talking to them in May and she says, do you want to go out to the bridge? And I said, what? What do you mean? She told me I fell off my chair. And everyone I have told this to has fallen off their chair. Our friends at CBS, I said, the killer bridge is at the park. They were left. I told Rod Roddenberry, the killer bridge is. Everybody's like, what? What? Well, but then we couldn't exactly. I was hearing where it was, and we got there, and our local tour guide went out that we rented the bus from, and he didn't find it. So the morning we went, we had this kind of edginess about whether it was really there or not. And I got to the gift shop first, and we went in, and I found a map, and it said, look here, it's not really highly promoted. And it's like, no, look, see, it says bridge and rocks and weeds and flora and fauna, and Captain Kirk was killed here. I went, see, it really is. So we get out there. People are still not knowing. We get out of the bus. We walk about an eighth of a mile, and there's a fork, and they're like, are you sure it's out here? I said, well, I'm following the path at the park, the map, the park sells. Went down there, and I thought, well, there's a bridge, but it doesn't look like, and I got around about three quarters, and I went, oh, my God, that's it, because it had the angled railings, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And everybody else would come around. I said, it's over here. Come, shut up. It's over here. Quit arguing. And everybody came around and went, that's not it. Oh, my God, it is. And it was just so weird. It's like everything else, it's the best part of the tour. Tara says this, and it just sounds like tour guide speak. But it really is. It goes inanimate object. It's like Tillman. It goes from being a sewer plant that some idiot, idealistic, liberal architect tried to make not just be a sewer plant. It goes from being a sewer plant to being, oh my God, that Starfleet Academy that I've watched a million times. This went from being this bridge over this dry wash out in the middle of nowhere to, oh my God, that's the bridge that killed Kirk. And so everyone's like taking pictures on it. And we took a group picture. And halfway through all that, I said, no, I don't want to know what the picture I want. And so I like got underneath it and did my, it was fun moment, you know, underneath. Uh-huh. So everybody just had it. And it was just, I mean, it was exciting and cool and awesome and little geek boy puddle in your pants moment to find it on top of the drama of, is it really? I felt like some badly scripted yeah. reality show, you know, where they're trying to drum up the drama. And our little bitty micro drama was, is it really out here? Is someone mm-hmm. like, do they have the wrong? We get there. No, it really is here. This is amazing. This is awesome. So every, you know, and we had one day people who had jumped in with it. So I've gone on and on about this, but it was not only, it was cool to be there. It was cool to see all the stuff. It was cool to get back and be the ones telling people 20 years later that this bridge that no one out here in established Trekland knew about, you know, the nine park rangers and their docents have known it for 20 years or whatever. Uh-huh. But, yeah. And I don't think they're putting it up like it's a big tourist attraction to lure all the Trek fans out there, but it's not quite Vasquez Rocks, you know, or the Tillman water plant, but, it may start getting a little more, you know, now that we've there and we kind of spread the word, maybe a few more people will stop.
Yeah.
by and go by there. But that was, I don't want to say that was the coolest moment of the tour, but that was sure one of the nice surprise moments. And I hope, you know, as we go forward, we're going to tweak it for, we're not going to do it again until 2016. We're talking about doing a lot of some radical new thing, keeping the best. Maybe, I even hate to say this, but maybe even my long sought wishing we could do something with San Francisco parts, adding that in. Mm. But yeah, I have to say, as much fun as the whole thing was, and it's always new. It's always got, there's always new people, a new mix of personalities, the Brits and the Aussies and everybody, you know, the personalities were great. And everybody, we just had everybody like wore their shirts more when we got to the con. It was just cool to see that group of blue and black bowling shirted people in a clump at times and at the bar at night. And that was just, that's just fun. I was just very proud. And Terrace was ecstatic. And so even if we don't have a, we won't have a full tour next year, but we're talking about having the day tour next year.
Okay.
For the con.
The one day thing. Yeah.
So yeah. Cool. So anyway, so that was the highlight for me that, but even when it's somewhere I've been before, it's still fun to watch. I mean, the other fun time was we shifted things around and we went to the Will Rogers Polo Field first at State Park where I docent. We went there first before we went to Santa Monica Pier. And it was a Sunday and I didn't even stop to think I should know this, but we got there about 2 o'clock and they were still playing polo on the field. So we couldn't go out to where the Bird of Prey was quote unquote parked, you know, we pulled the bus up and and somebody said, oh, is it where the horses are? And I looked out and I'm like, oh, I didn't even think that since we're here this early in the afternoon that we can't walk on the field and go take our pictures because they're playing. But they were actually like in the last 2 or 3 minutes of the game. And I was turned around and went, okay, everybody, you want me to like jump into my Will Rogers tour voice here before we, while we're waiting? So, but anyway, the game went away and everybody got to run over and take their, look, the gate's open and Jillian's going to drive her old blue pickup up here any minute now kind of pictures.
And, well, it's a good thing that Kirk didn't try to land the Bird of Prey there during a match and with the horses out there. So
you know, it's a good thing Sulu didn't drop the transparent aluminum on him right there.
It's a good thing they arrived there at night in the voyage home. So
yeah.
All right. Well, when you guys get the details planned for the next one, we will bring that to everyone here on the show. So good to hear how things turned out. And let's go on. Well, before we go into the next news story, we do have a quick little plug for ourselves here for everyone. And this is to tell everyone about our new Patreon page.
Oh, I heard about this.
Yeah. I think actually, Larry, you and I recorded some exclusive bits to put on the page there. And
yes.
And I don't like the word exclusive that much personally, but these really are only going to be available there on our Patreon page.
Okay, they're elitist bits.
For our patrons. I don't know about that. So what Patreon is, for those who don't know, is it's a lot like Kickstarter, except it's a way for you to support the creatives that you love on a monthly basis by making a contribution. And you can contribute as little as you want, a dollar, or as much as you want. And we have different contribution levels with perks listed out for you on the page. All sorts of things that you can get in exchange, all the way from things like digital wallpaper, all the way up to actually getting producer credits on the show and even helping us plan out content here on the network. We have all kinds of things for you there. And you just go to patreon.com/trekfm to find it all. We also have listed out goals, challenges that we have right now, things that we need funding for, so you can see what it is that you can help us with. And as I mentioned, we're going to have some special content there, actual exclusive content there that's only available to our patrons. So when you go there and you view our activity feed, you'll see some items that you can view as a member of the public. And you'll see other items that will say that you must be a patron. And some of those are some behind-the-scenes bits here with Larry, which we recorded recently. And we hope you'll drop by and see what we've got going on there and that you'll support us there, because we really do need your support to keep the network going. And this will be a great way for you to do it and also for us to interact with you and give you some perks in exchange. So again, that's patreon.com/trekfm. And we really thank you for supporting us there.
Well, I'm looking forward to the day when I can look around, you know, Vegas Trek or Comic-Con and see Trek FM tote bags, Trek FM coffee mugs. And
I hope. We're trying to get there.
Or so whatever.
We definitely want to be there at the conventions. Well, Larry, let's go on to the next story here. And two things happened over the past few days, maybe the past week, that really got my attention in the world of fan films. And one of them is that Star Trek Continues, which I think I know the guy that played McCoy in a few episodes of that series, won a Geeky Award for Best Web Series. And the other thing is that Star Trek Axanar just shattered Kickstarter by blowing past their baseline goal of $100,000, blowing past all their stretch goals, and actually finishing at $638,471 from 8,548 contributors. And these two things together just really highlighted for me the fact that Star Trek fandom is screaming for new Star Trek. Mm-hmm. Both of these, Star Trek Continues and Star Trek Axanar, are both so well-produced and well-written and well-acted, and really highlights what fans and creative professionals who are Star Trek fans can do with a very small budget. And the fans are just turning out en masse to support these things. What do you think about what's happening with the fan films and fandom and support right now?
I think it's good.
Is this Larry from Oklahoma?
Yeah, it's nice. No, I'm sorry, I'm kidding. No, of course it's amazing. That's where our technology is. I think, you know, this is kind of the, I mean, you're doing pod, you've got your podcast empire. I mean, Star Trek Online, this, the whole concept, someone was telling me at Vegas about how they were trying to find a way, people are having their, first of all, I missed the guy that was doing the 3D printing of, you give them a picture and it does the 3D, like you have an action figure.
Right, you know, right.
People mm-hmm. are wanting, who are really into Star Trek Online, or they have their ship, they have their character, their persona, whatever. They're getting it, you know, either as an image or a shirt or a model of the ship or their character themselves, or the cosplayers are having themselves done in different costumes. I mean, we're at a time when the technology has allowed, you know, one-off things, like people are creating their ships, or they're prop builders, or they're cosplayers big time, or costumers, whether they're playing or not. And the culmination of all that is kind of, you know, the writers, which we've always had, you know, zine writers and script writers. And the culmination now is the fan films. But the underlying thing here is, it's like, okay, guys, you know, Paramount/CBS/whoever has got the reins now. You created this monster. You know, you had us at Check the Circuit. First mm-hmm. line of the cage, tribute mm-hmm. pups. You know, it's like you had us at 1966. So don't chicken out on us now. You know, and it's like I said, it's like what I used to say when they had the dead times. Star Trek is not dead. It's way too big a franchise. I didn't know that the numbers would come up. The JJ movies are a lot of that. A lot of it's the remasters. A lot of it's the Blu-rays. A lot of it is just the Netflix availability. And a lot of it is people just now, those access points or whatever, people just now coming around. Mm-hmm. And we live in this tech age, and we live with 24/7 media. And it's almost like we've hit a critical mass point where it's gone crazy. And it's, you know, in the aughts, when people were looking at Enterprise and the TV franchise, oh, Star Trek's getting old and tired, and what's the solution? Go back to our roots. And so the whole Bad Robot solution was go back to our roots, only we're scared to write canon, so let's do an alternate universe and we won't wipe mm-hmm. out canon. But I don't think anybody has to worry about that. I mean, people just want their Star Trek. And I tried to say at the time, everybody fixated on the movie. And we'd all wake up eventually one day and go, oh, that's just two, like I famously say, that's 2 hours every 4 years. And the novels are great. And, you know, kudos to David and Dayton and Kevin and David and Keith and all of them and the novels they do. But people are, you know, devour those, and IDW and the comics, and people devour that. Mm-hmm. And STO lets people have a, you know, a bite out of it. So, yeah, all those things together. And some of those things are licensed and official and old school. And very helpful. And then there's all this cutting edge about, you know, the fan films are in a gray area. Other things going on are kind of in a, technology is allowing these things. And eventually, hopefully the licensors will catch up and mm-hmm. have a comfort. And if there's not a comfort zone, find one. But it's where we are. It's 2014. That's where the landscape is. And yes, Gene and Rick and everybody under them created this monster, and it's now Feed the Beast. And Barry Switzer and OU football used to talk about, we've got to feed the beast. Mm-hmm. We created Sooner football, and now, you know, it's like the thing that we wanted is what we have to keep feeding, or it's going to consume us. Yeah. And that's what Star Trek is. Sorry to slip in a non-Alabama college reference in on you there.
Well, we're the same. I mean, you know, I mean, we have an 11-1 season, and it's like death and gloom, and oh my God, what happened? It's the worst season we've had ever.
Why? What happened, lost one Chris? Game. Did you guys wind up losing a game after all?
I think we lost a game to some team that stole our colors and wears the same colors.
Oh, no, you lost a team that decided to have a quarterback show up or grow up, get big boy pants on. Anyway, we won't go there.
But you said critical mass, and I think that's the thing. Like, what I see here is everyone's asking, when is there going to be a new series? When are we going to have more Star Trek? And we're not getting it. And there's just sort of this quiet about it, like, there's no word. And so we've got Star Trek Continues. We've got Star Trek XNR. Of course, there's Phase 2, which has been around for more than a decade. And they're all bringing us a new Star Trek. And when they need help, the fans are turning out.
Well, there's like a new Star Trek fan film, whether or not they all come to fruition or not. There's like a new one. I don't want to say it's a joke. I don't want to make fun, because I wish everybody the best. I've been in Phase 2 productions before. I was McCoy. I'm still a creative consultant on Continues. I support all the fan films, and the bar is going higher and higher for everybody. Yeah. The Farragut that Continues partners with, their bar has gotten higher and higher. The Yorktown is going to finally restore the thing that George Takei was in the 80s. That's going to be restored. Mm-hmm. The Exeter finally finished their last act from 10 years ago, and that was a completed show. And people are springing up all the time. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's a level of responsibility, especially when they ask people for funds, and we hope everything, you know, comes across. But and it's not just the original series. People are doing original angles. They're doing a next gen era, you know, pieces.
We've got an Enterprise era film.
Oh, we do. That's right. That's
with
right.
Horizon,
oh, I really want to see that. So, it's like all the manifestations of Star Trek. But that's what Star Trek does. I came up with this phrase years ago when I was talking on the documentary for the original, not our tour, but for the original tour show that now got split up into two pieces with the two bridges. Mm-hmm. And I said, there is something about the original Star Trek, and the first time you get into it, especially if you were an original series person, and Next Gen 2 for the people that found it new then. But there's something that makes you want to climb inside your TV, that makes you want to go to that fictional universe. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you know, by the time you get that bug, you know what's going to be down that corridor and around the left, even though you've never seen it on the show.
Right.
They did such an amazing job of fleshing out this universe, even on their tiny little $1.50 budget, you know, or their $1.5 million budget from the 80s. They did such an incredible job that not only do you want to go through your TV screen and go live there, you'd be at home there in 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know exactly where to go, what to do, and go and you'd be Jillian Taylor without having seen a rerun before you got sucked into the bird of prey and went back in time with them in the whales. I mean, you would be totally at home in that world, and you would know how to run around inside it. And you want to run around inside it. And so what are you going to do? I'm going to make my prop. I'm going to make my costume. I'm going to design my ship. And now, damn it, I'm going to do all that together and write a story and do a fan film. And it's not even a service to keep calling some of these fan films,
right?
So yay for Continues, for Ferris of them all winning the Geeky Award, and that was amazing. And I want to say thank you to Vic, who gave a lot of people a shout out that weren't there that night. They only had so much room for people, but he thanked me and all the rest, a ton of the rest of the Star Trek Continues family. So I want to say I was not expecting that. I didn't expect him to give him enough time to do it, to start off with. And then he rattled off. He had them on his pad, on his phone, 15 or 20 people that he gave thanks to. Mm-hmm. And that was very cool. And congrats to Alec and the Axanar. I'm still trying to figure out, because that all happened when I was like on my deathbed. So
it was quick. I mean, amazing. We were watching it build, and then with less than 2 days to go, George Takei tweeted it out, and then I mean, it was already like four times funded already, but when George Takei tweeted it out, it was like floodgates, like 3,000 new backers and another $250,000 on top of what had already been there. So it was amazing.
And see, and that's the numbers or something too, because that's, it's kind of like these political campaigns that go, oh, is it the fat cat donors? No, it's everybody giving 20 bucks. You know, it's like,
yeah, it's this small
vast
amounts,
grassroots, right? A million people. Absolutely. And I say, not literally, but virtually, like that. The millions of people giving a small amount adds up faster than
absolutely
than the big donations.
Well, that was with the, I guess the last thing on this topic, with Reading Rainbow and what LeVar Burton did.
Right.
And
right.
By the way, at the Geeky Awards, he won like Geek of the Year, I guess, from that. But I looked, because I donated to that as well, and I looked to see what the donor levels were, like which ones had the most. It was mostly $1 and $5. That's how they got to that enormous amount of money. It really adds up. So people think, you know, giving a dollar doesn't make a difference, or $5 doesn't make a difference with any of these kinds of things, but it really does add up.
And this whole, I mean, when I first started the Con of Wrath, Kickstarter was so new that I knew one guy that he was telling me about it in 2011. And in just that short a time, it's almost become like this mini industry, and there are Kickstarter gurus, and there are Kickstarters that still come out with very good pedigrees that don't make it. It's sad on one hand that there has to be this whole science and this art and craft of having a Kickstarter, and people who you would think and who ought to have enough weight that would have, you know, people would jump aboard it. But sometimes it's just a matter of catching. I know you're going to have George Pappy and the Green Girl on later on. And there are just these moments in history where people that ought to have a floodgate, have the wind in their sails, just don't. And there are perfectly good Kickstarter and Indiegogo and crowdfunding campaigns that totally deserve to be funded. And either and you hate to say, well, I'm sorry, I just didn't have a savvy Kickstarter coach or something. But then there are some things that catch the wind and just take off. And, you know, Mark Zakri's Space Command show did that. Sometimes it's the geek kid. I don't know. I think there are people still sitting around writing PhD dissertations about what, you know, I can see this whole new field for this coming up. What is it that helps that? Having George Takei tweet you helps a whole lot. But what is it that separates, you know, in these genre shows, whether they're Star Trek strictly or not, or next door to it? I don't know. It's just, it's, but, you know, it's still, there's no guarantees. Every year is a new year. As far as just if you're trying to do a product, people who have a totally good pedigree and a great project don't have their Kickstarters work out. But yeah, your original premise that all of these events are a barometer that people are screaming for new Star Trek. That's, it's obvious. It's obvious.
Well, people are not only screaming for new Star Trek, but they're also screaming for past Star Trek in high definition. And this is something...
Boy, that was a nice turn you made there.
And this is something I get asked about all the time. And of course, as a Niner, I really, really want to see DS9 in HD. And of course, we've been teased with it now with Birthright. Now that TNG Season 6 Blu-rays are out, and we can actually see what DS9 looks like in HD. And this has been talked about a lot, but there was a panel at Star Trek Las Vegas with the Okudas, and then Roger Ley Jr., who has done a lot of the Blu-ray work along with Robert Meyer Burnett, was interviewed by Nerdist, and he was talking about DS9 there a bit as well. And he said, it sounds sad, but it's a business decision when it should be a creative one. But you need sales in order to put out more product. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. We're hoping to get news within the next several months. But if fans want to do anything to make this happen, pick up these Blu-ray sets right now, because the entire Next Generation collection will be out. You know, by the end of the year here, we'll have Season 7. And unfortunately, that is, first of all, that is what it comes down to, right? I mean, it is sales. The studio is looking at this as a financial investment.
It's like ratings, it's like sales, it's like favorites and clicks and views, and it's numbers. It's numbers, yeah.
And the other thing he pointed out was from Season 4, especially onward in DS9, you have a new challenge that you didn't have with remastering TNG, which is there is a lot of stuff that's completely digital, and there aren't any models for these ships, and for a lot of this stuff, you've got to just redo it all. You've got to start over from scratch. That's not the case with everything, but there's a lot of stuff like that. And then he also mentions, as I just alluded to in the quote here, TNG Blu-ray sales will impact the decision on DS9 and Voyager. But the other thing, Larry, that I feel like people are missing in this whole discussion that I rarely hear anyone talk about, everyone's focused on Blu-rays, and you'll read fan comments criticizing the Blu-rays. You know, well, first of all, the Blu-rays are more expensive. But another one I see is that, oh, Blu-rays, they're a dying media format that's on its way out already. Which, first of all, I don't think that's true. But the other thing is that focusing on Blu-rays feels like missing part of the picture here, because here in Japan, all the Star Trek series are shown on television, and we show almost no standard definition content anymore, and we haven't for years in Japan. As soon as TNG came out in HD, it was switched over here, and now we're seeing HD. And of course, TOS has been HD here going all the way back to when it was remastered. And Enterprise.
Don't make that sound like it was in the 80s. That was just like in the late aughts, okay? Okay.
It's a decade
all
ago.
All the way back
now.
When it was remastered.
But so it's HD, right? And I think that, you know, so much, the studio gets a lot of residual income from these shows being in syndication,
especially
in foreign markets, not only in the US. And I think there will be a time soon where networks, foreign networks especially, will say, we're not going to buy this from you anymore if it's standard definition, because we don't even have, we're not putting that stuff out anymore. Our system's not set up for it. It's got to be HD. So I think the investment isn't simply Blu-rays and selling media. I think that it's making this content, which is timeless. I mean, people are going to be watching Star Trek 100 years from now. I know it has to be brought up to date and remastered in order for it to remain viable. What's your view on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's sad to say, but it's like you're holding a lot of old TV shows that the first year or two were in black and white, and nobody wants to see the black and white years, even though you're missing, until you get like really obscure rerun channels, like here in the States, Antenna or MeTV or something.
Like black and white TV?
Black and white TV, yeah.
Is that an actual network?
Well, it's like no one wants to see the first, you know, season of I Dream of Jeannie or Bewitched or Gilligan's Island or... you know, or Petticoat Junction or something, because it was not the color year. Because as we all know, nothing happened if it happened in black and white. So, which is why it was so vital that The Cage was remastered. But yeah, okay, you went through several topics there. First of all, yes, this expectation that fans just think of the Trek family as this big, tethered together, you know, everything is inevitably linked.
Right.
And we all kind of intrinsically know that there is this, I mean, every time I do a panel at a convention, I always do my show of hands, and we go through what people's favorite shows are and what brought them into the fandom and where they're coming from. And original series and next gen are still the most popular, depending on where I am and where we are. TNG will outdo original series, and the rest of them are lesser children, but they're all still there. And DS9 always has far more fans now than it did when it was on. And Enterprise is the same way. And Voyager either has nobody there, or the Janeway fan club was meeting and there's, you know, 80 people there for Voyager.
And that's like weird to me to hear that, because online it feels like Voyager, Voyager, Voyager all the time.
Maybe that's because you have a direct comm link to the Delta Quadrant.
Oh, okay.
No, not. But again, it depends on the location and the con and what the vibe is and all that. No, it's kind of Voyager. I mean, you know, I always talk about DS9 being the middle child, and they both, in their different ways, are. It's like DS9's the middle boy child and Voyager's the middle girl child. I don't know, the middle daughter. I don't know. It's kind of weird. And then, Enterprise is like Maggie that can't talk yet, but everybody knows is there. I don't know. It's weird. It's but we all know that original series and next gen numbers wise, but people just expect that the whole family, it's like original series is grandpa and next gen is the dad and the movies are mom. I don't know. I'm getting weird with my illusions, but it's like everybody expects the whole family to be there. And that is not the way that the accountants and the business guys see it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it was a huge breakthrough. They laid out a lot of money on the original series. The remastering. And the other thing is, these have all been a different critter. The remastering project, what they all needed was a totally different recipe. I mean, the original series needed the original optical film effects to be up-res, to be made, to be CGI.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a matter of taking the original film stock, because the original film stock was, you know, glows of light and remodel, you know, the model reused from the entire.
Right.
Next gen was a matter of having the film stock that had been, you know, dumbed down for compositing on video, but the original film was there. It was just a matter of finding everything. And that was a lot of work, but it was work mostly done, where next gen, I mean, original series was a lot of redoing. Now, you mentioned that interview. DS9's problem is it started with physical models and fourth season CGI entered into it. But even there, it was Gary Hutzel's team. Gary Hutzel held on to, as you'll find out when you get your DS9 finale Trek edition of Trekland on speaker.
Volume
you'll
three.
Hear, yeah, volume three at nemecheck.com. at Gary Hutzel hung on to, I remember the years going by. It was like Voyager, and they were alternating teams. They would do every other episode on both series. So there were four teams, two on DS9 and two on Voyager. Mm-hmm. And eventually they were all under Dan. And they would go, the non-Gary team went to CGI earlier on DS9, but Gary held out because he just did not think it was up to what he wanted to do. And it wasn't until the last season when he wasn't farming it out to a house, but he had the control and his people had the control in-house more to his satisfaction, that they started. So the seventh season of DS9 was the only true all-digital year. But okay. 4 and 5 and 6, increasingly, every other show was digital. Because Gary mm-hmm. was pushing motion control. They found out that the Hallmark Bird of Prey ornament was the perfect scale to match the big DS9 miniature. So when they were doing the Klingon Civil War or the Klingon War shows on DS9, like fourth season when Worf came mm-hmm. over, that mm-hmm. arc, they would get to cut money. I mean, to cram as much as they could on their little budgets they had. They would go raid licensing and get 6 or 7 sample Hallmark Bird of Prey ornaments and string them together like they were flying in formation and not put it in the foreground, but they would put it in the background to get to when they were trying to layer right. in and get these the feeling of these major battles. Uh-huh. They pushed the envelope so far for what they could do with a dime. So that was all, but it was still all motion control. It was not digital. It was live stuff, even though it was little shortcuts as much as they mm-hmm. could pull off. So A, you've got some split, you've got some digital and some, but even there, you're going to have to go back and recreate the digital for high def. Yes. And also your original elements may have to have some work done because some of the stuff, if it gets HD'd, may not, you may not want right. to see that, you know, not want to see the Hallmark ornaments in the background mm-hmm. or the famous kitbash fleet on DS9 where they were needing more, whether it was debris ships or it was just more ships in the background. What was it? The one ship in the war shows was one of the kitbashes that looked pretty good, and so they wound up using it. Charlie Reynolds' ship or whatever it was never meant to be a foreground ship, and it got pressed into service and was that way. So anyway, so there's a whole unique, you know, and then Voyager started out being all live models, and then both teams increasingly went over to digital, and it was early digital before it got better, and there's different quality. And so, but yeah, the bottom line is, it's not an automatic thing, and fans need to get that. Yeah. And it is about the money. Yeah. And those will need huge outlays to go back mm-hmm. through. And the records for those shows are not as, I mean, the more the shows went along and reused elements, what helped Next Gen become doable was they kept such an anal, great recording system for where all the original pieces of film were.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to go back, and it was all still stored and not thrown away. So they were able to go back and find it. And as more and more of that stuff got reused for the live stuff, when they would shoot live models, it's not quite as detailed and, you know what I'm saying? It's not such right. a great paper trail and a storage and archive.
Exactly.
So those are all extenuating circumstances why it'll just be, it won't quite be the same.
Well, what is your feeling to close out between it happening in the near future, it happening eventually, or never happening?
Well, I haven't had my ear real close to this, but what I keep hearing is people are concerned. I mean, I know Ira wants to do it. Ira's working on some documentary threads himself to go, you know, to be bonus material for this. But the core item of the releases is the episodes themselves. And it's really on the bubble. It's on the bubble, just like a series being renewed. They talk about a series being on the bubble. Mm-hmm. It's yes, I don't want to doom anything, but the next gen sales have tailed off just a little bit. They're not as, it's not that people don't love the later years. I just think a little bit of it is the new has worn off, as we say back home.
Do you think part of it is, you can watch it on Netflix, and so why buy the media for a lot? Because a lot of people don't care about the special features like I do. A lot of people, they just want to watch the episode, and if it's HD and they can stream it, then that's good enough for them.
Yeah, but then, you know, the good thing here is that the DS9 audience is growing. I mean, I can tell that. I can see the show of hands of people who were watching it when it aired versus people who are fans now. And I know that's because of Netflix. It's not because of any other reason and the access. And we live in a dark, you know, all we hash out these reasons. We live in a darker time. It's post 9/11. DS9 was getting into all this stuff when it was still the happy dappy 90s. And now here we are. And in a lot of ways went through the Gene Roddenberry thing of Star Trek in a darker way than the happier shows did, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. So people appreciate that. And they look at, and some people even said, oh my God, of all the shows, DS9 is the one that holds up the best. Well, that may be true. And I can partly agree with that. But then that pendulum will swing back, and 10 years from now, somebody will say something else about one of the shows, and it'll all be different. And we'll go, oh my God, this is what we thought about in the teens. But there are way more fans. That's made it easier. But there are, you know, the conventional wisdom of the people that hold the purse strings, everyone knew that original series and Next Gen were the big money makers and had the numbers. All the others, and Enterprise was a caveat because it was easy, because it was digital to begin with. So the two middle kids are going to be the ones that are going to be, have to get over the hump. And they're going to, and they're the ones that people are the most, the people with the purse strings are the most skittish about jumping in. I mean, inevitably, yeah, and what you said about timing, but it's not this automatic spit it out. Here's, you know, 6 months later, here's the next one, just marching off on the assembly line. Mm-hmm. It isn't that way. And I know people complain about the price of the Blu-ray sets, like Next Gen and all, but you can usually find a good deal on those. It's really about the numbers and the sales.
The list price is high, but if you wait around, you can get them for a pretty reasonable price.
It's just like, it's not just Star Trek. That's the racket of the industry, it seems.
Yeah, exactly. Well, glad.
No, people have got to get the numbers. Yeah.
Be glad you guys aren't living in Japan, because just a DVD box, until recently, just a DVD box set of one season of Star Trek would be equivalent of $250 in the U.S. And the Blu-rays are more than that even right now. So I order them all from the States because it's cheaper.
Do you think, not to get off on a tangent here, heaven forbid, do you think Star Trek fandom, quote unquote, in Japan, I mean, I was always shocked when I saw how tiny it was, because you always think, oh, Japan, science fiction, oh. And somebody finally said, look, it's all about the way the people that schedule, who buy the programming for local countries, what they do with Star Trek. Do they treat it as a kiddie show, or do they treat it as an adult show? And if it's treated as a kiddie show, it never grows an audience. But if it's treated as an adult show, like it was in Germany and the UK and Australia back in the 70s and 80s, then it develops that way. And if it's just, they just blow it off in some country and stick it on their Saturday morning equivalent, it never, is Trek fandom growing in Japan?
I don't really think so, personally. Now, Into Darkness made twice as much money as 2009 did.
Right. I know they're desperately trying to take the JJ movies and try to make a dent in that.
But that means that Into Darkness made $10 million, whereas 2009 made $5 million. So that's not exactly a lot of people, especially when the average movie ticket here is about $25. So, again, that's not a huge number of people going to see this movie. You know, I don't know. The official Starships collection ships seem to be selling pretty well. I've actually been surprised how they're moving in the bookstores.
And in Japan.
In Japan, yeah.
Well, the little techie shippy things. I mean, I got a set of ships the Japanese made for some kind of premium from 10, 15 years ago that I had a lot of these little cool ships that never were made as models, but I knew that this company did that. Mm-hmm. So, they've used premiums and polybagged and add-on gifts and things. Mm-hmm. And, FactFiles has done stuff like that. So that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. So I think they're trying to grow it. There's a new initiative. There is a Japanese language version of, it's not really StarTrek.com. It's very pared down, but it's sort of like the database portion of that, sort of the encyclopedic version in Japanese now, which was launched maybe late last year. But I don't know, maybe they're trying to grow it. I think it's a big challenge. I think here it's just Star Wars is huge here. Science fiction is big here.
Yeah.
Trek itself just isn't for some reason. I think it's just the subject matter, maybe the complexity of the language and the technobabble and the topics that are being dealt with.
Are you saying, JJ, that it's too intellectual? Is that what you're saying there?
No, not that it's too intellectual, but it's just like, does it connect or not? If you look at sitcoms, Friends did really well here. Seinfeld crashed and burned because it didn't connect. The subject matter just didn't really connect with the audience. So it just kind of depends on that. Mm. And to this day, Full House remains one of the most popular American exports on television for some reason. So,
because you've got the little girls.
So I don't know. Well, I guess my final thought on this is that I think that it will eventually happen because I think the studio has to do it because there's money to be had in this material for decades or centuries to come. But I'm not expecting to see any DS9 Blu-rays in the stores next year, or maybe not even the year after that, personally.
Well, your point about programmers driving demand, it reminds me of, we didn't get a new series after the 70s and even the 80s. I mean, a couple of things happened. 86, Star Trek IV, the whales one. Mm-hmm. It was a Friends episode, the whales, the one with the whales. The one with the whales. The one with the Nazis, the one with the Romans, the one with the whale, Star Trek Friends. That was the biggest, it wasn't the biggest box office, but it was the biggest crossover appeal movie up until then. It was a big thing. And all the hoopla about the 20th anniversary and being on the cover of Newsweek in 86. And those were all kind of key factors. But the biggest thing that hit was, for several years, all the local stations that syndicated the original series were going, Come on, guys. We're showing the same damn 79 shows over and over and over. Can you get us something new, please? Mm-hmm. And then it was like, well, how will we do that? And, but that was driven by the programmers. It was domestic. No one cared about foreign men. But, but that said, when you talk about them demanding, HD or nothing, because people are going to laugh at it. It's kind of what I was trying to say about the black and whites. It's like they don't think anyone's going to watch standard, just like people don't think.
Right.
On a regular channel, it's not a black and white channel, that people are going to watch something of that degree, and it turns into, and when it becomes a groundswell and you have country after country, demanding that, maybe that's 2 or 3 or 4 years behind the curve, and that will finally
push. Could be, yeah.
Or maybe we'll just have some technological revolutions that will, maybe we'll have one-click Photoshop photo upgrade and color correction.
Yeah, just put the SD episodes in, you press a button, it comes out
HD. Yeah. All those people that were about to throw away their 35mm clips, from Lincoln, because all their slides went red, and now you can scan a slide in one click and have it back. I didn't throw my slides away from, my film clips away from the 70s and 80s.
Well, in 1986, no one thought we would have transparent aluminum, and we have it now, so.
Aye, laddie, that's the ticket. You never know.
All right. Well, we'll see where this goes. So, that's all we have in news for this week. So, Larry, let's bring in George Pappy and talk about The Green Girl. We'll be right back.
She's the only constant thing in a million different dreams. Sometimes she's green. You're not my hero. What are you doing in my world?
One of the most famous aliens in Star Trek is the Orion slave girl. And the most classic green moment comes from The Cage, Compliments of Vina. The actress behind Vina, Susan Oliver, is best known to Star Trek fans for this role, yet her appearance in Star Trek is but a speck on the landscape of her career as an actress and director. Today, we're going to take a break from our usual series rotation and episode discussion format to talk about The Green Girl, the new documentary about Susan Oliver. And there's no better source than the writer and director himself, George Pappy. George, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here. And I've actually been intending to invite you on to the show for a while now to talk about this documentary. And Larry suggested that we could make it happen this weekend. So Larry, thanks for that.
Right, Chris. My pleasure.
So George, let's talk about the genesis of this documentary. And like most Star Trek fans, I, of course, knew Susan Oliver as Vina from The Cage. And as I watch the trailer and look into bits about the documentary and see credits of things that she's been in, I realized that I've seen all these other shows growing up that she was in, and it never really crossed my mind. So tell me what got you so interested in Susan Oliver and led you to take on this project and do this documentary?
Well, it was about 3 years ago in the summer of 2011, and I'm watching The Cage again, the original Cage, which you can now watch. And I looked her up on my iPhone on the Internet Movie Database, imdb.com. And, you know, I often do that now. And a lot of times when you look these guest stars up on Star Trek, you know, you'll see someone who had a couple dozen credits, and they probably haven't worked a lot of them in many, many years. Mm-hmm. And I was just shocked at what I saw when I looked her up. As you alluded to, she's got well over 100 major credits on just about every major television show from the late 50s till about the mid 70s. And it's just, I didn't know any of this. And I was rather shocked that I didn't know any of this. The only things I knew her from were this, the Cage, and the Twilight Zone episode she did with Roddy McDowell. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to know more about her. She just really jumps out in that episode. And even when I was a kid watching The Menagerie, she jumped out, and it's such a powerful performance. And I was a little bit embarrassed with myself that I didn't know all this, because I know a lot about a lot of, you know, entertainment trivia. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things like, how do you miss something that big? You know, and yet it's gone largely missed. So that was a little bit bothersome to me. And I, and the more I researched her, the more fascinating she became, because there's a lot of other unusual things we can get into about her besides just being this very prolific actress. And I just felt like it's just a real shame that that got so, I don't know if forgotten is the right word or never even acknowledged is the right word.
So I'm curious, Larry, because when we talk, you often throw out TV references that I don't always get, and I know you're very steeped in the television of that time, especially 60s, 70s television. Were you aware of how much stuff Susan Oliver had done?
No. I mean, that's by the time I was a kid, I was really catching maybe the last half of her career. But what's been interesting the last year or two, I've gotten really hooked on, here in the States, there's two channels, MeTV and Antenna TV, that show 50s, 60s, 70s reruns all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a time when I was up late at night working on some projects this spring. And here's, you know, of all things, Father Knows Best. And bang, she's this cousin that shows up. I was like, oh my God, it's Susan Oliver. And that was after I had talked to George and the documentary was rolling gear. But it really, I mean, he's got so many clips in there. And a lot of that's really like sacred footage you're not going to see on even a rerun channel. I mean, there's a lot of shows that you just don't see, period, anymore. If you could even, I don't know, he can say whether you can get it on DVD or you've got to get them from collector's archives or something. But no, I mean, I knew she was around, obviously. But yeah, you just, that's why he titled this so well, I think. It's the obvious thing, The Green Girl. That's what, even people who aren't Star Trek fans, have seen right. those images and they think of that. Yeah. And it's not so much a, cramming her into a box as it is finding that doorway to get people to step through the door and go, oh my, you know, walk into the TARDIS, as it were, and see the room inside that's much bigger than it is outside. You think, oh, Susan Oliver's career, bang. And you go, oh my God. And then when they get lined up in the documentary, it's just a fraction of the things. That one bit you have, George, where it's just the title clips, you know, it's mm-hmm. her title credit on all these shows. And a lot of times back then they would actually have the mm-hmm. name with a clip of you. Not, it wouldn't just be running randomly in the opening scene. It would actually be with their face. And it's like, ding, 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 ding. And you even go black and white to color. And here she is on Bonanza and on, you know, and on, not Gunsmoke, but some of the color shows she's in, and it even gets into color. And you're like, oh, okay, it's slapping me in the face here. I get it. And I was the same way. It was like, oh my God, I didn't realize. All those years of watching her and knowing mm-hmm. she was just vaguely familiar and not knowing it. But no, I didn't. But I was a kid. I'm not paying attention to guest stars.
That's the thing too, because I mean, I grew up, I was watching Bonanza and stuff as well. And I remember all that stuff, and I'm watching those credits go by. I'm like, okay, I watched all these shows, never connected the dots there.
Yeah, but we were on the little side of life, to be fair to us. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that one of the guys, I mean, I interviewed 40 different people, Larry being one of them, for this documentary, and we had a couple of really wonderful television and movie historians. Larry kind of falls in that category too, and one of them, Tom Lasanti, who's written some great books. I think one of them, his most famous one, is B-Movie Queens of 60s Cinema. So he knew a lot about her and a lot of other actresses of her era. And he said she was kind of like a chameleon, which was perfect for television. But she just kind of, because she was a chameleon, you often didn't realize you were seeing her. It just, in fact, someone, somewhere along the line, recently in the world of Trek, I can't remember where, maybe it was even at the convention, told me it took them until they were much older watching the Menagerie again to realize that the green Orion slave woman was the same girl that was playing Vina, because it seemed so different. She just, even within that role, for a kid anyways, seemed like it was different actresses. And she just really could lose herself in a role. To her detriment, as far as her ongoing fame went, I think.
I've got it, Larry. Susan Oliver is the Jeffrey Combs of the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Okay, Chris, if you want to only be on Trek. So, yeah. Because we talk about her, but she was, you know, it was just this one role in the first pilot. And their makeup budgets were so tiny, then they couldn't have an actor back five times with a different alien head on.
Right. Because
they didn't have... unless you were Janos Prohaskis in the Mugato 1 week and the Horde of the next week and, you know, Yarnak the next week. But if you weren't a little Hungarian stuntman, then I guess you, you didn't qualify like the later generations would be.
Well, let's talk about her impact on Star Trek, because as you mentioned earlier, the general public, even people who don't know much about Star Trek, know this image of the green Orion slave girl. Do you think that if Susan Oliver, what kind of impact does that scene have on Star Trek and making it the phenomenon that it became, especially within pop culture of the time? What if there had never been a green Orion slave girl played by Susan Oliver?
Well, the first thing that jumped into my mind when you mentioned that is it really, because Star Trek became known, the original Star Trek, once the series got going, became known for William Ware Thies and his very pushing the envelope, risque costuming. And
the hanging by a thread was, theory.
And I think the theory was it looks like it's about to fall off, and how close to it actually falling off can we get?
Well, there was episode that they didn't shoot called How Is That Staying On?
Yeah,
that was the title.
Right.
Rejected this.
Is there in truth no gravity? That's what that
right. Yeah. He was the master of the double-sided tape and sewing them into their outfits and using Velcro. But my point is, in that pilot, she's the only one that falls in that category. By the time the series got going, at least after the second pilot, the female crew members were dressed that way largely too. I mean, look at Uhura. I mean, look at them all. I mean, look at Janice Rand.
They went to the miniskirts,
Yes, but
for uniform.
In this pilot, Susan Oliver's the only one that early on, but it's certainly setting a tone for the way they're going to, and that became an essential ingredient of a Star Trek episode. Who's the pretty girl this week? And you know, I they wanted to get extra viewers, I think, you know, and Gene Roddenberry was kind of a big fan of that, you know, and is what it is. But I don't know, Larry, what do you think about that?
Well, what got me was one of the things because George came up to me, I think at Vegas or I forget what convention, and said, would you want to talk to me about this? And I said, sure, but I didn't know Susan Oliver, and I'm not a bit, you know. And he says, I just want you to talk about her Star Trek angle, which is what you're asking, Chris. So he comes and we sit down and do it. And one thing I enjoyed was, aside from just knowing the standard bit about her in the show and the, you know, her whole overall character, even though we think about Venus, we think about the slave girl scene, how it was all through the show. And she actually does run around in that diaphanous little mini skirt that's meant to look like the same material that Talosians, you know, they've made her skirt out of the same thing that they're wearing. She's not bad looking, even when she's not in green, if what I'm trying to get to here. But until she's playing other characters like the demure wife on the picnic and all that kind of thing. But and the princess, you know, with the Kalar on Rigel 7 fight. But where you took the conversation and got to me and told me some bits that I didn't know, like this biography that apparently, if there's any collectors out there, she wrote a biography that was like underprinted, undervalued, and now they're hard to get. And the last six copies were out there when he started this documentary. And we were just talking about this the other night. And now the people you talked to all ran out and grabbed it. So now there's like no books anywhere you can get. But how she talked about the, and I should let George talk about this, but how she talked about how the crew, even when she came out, she'd been filming, I think this was day six or day seven, and she'd been filming and she came out in her green and the crew was like, oh my God, they either were leering at her or they couldn't look at her. And what it just said about, the, you know, just guys she'd been working with for several days, just the crew on the stage. And what that said and how she played that a little bit. And also the fact that she wasn't a trained dancer, that she just worked on the choreography at home. Mm-hmm. And the bigger thing about, here's Gene, even in 64, with everything else he wants to talk about and do, it's kind of like a little inkling into what Justice became on Next Generation. You know, it's like, okay, I'm going to take this sex thing and just rub it in your eye, TV, you know, poke you in the eye with it. Just that one little scene, but it really does get into the psyche, and she even touched on it. And that, anyway, that's what George got out of me. We went down this road of talking about it, and I was kind of amazed because I hadn't really thought about it in that term. So kudos to you, George. But the other thing was, since that's the doorway he's using for her, like through the title, like I said, and then he goes through the whole rest of her life. But the opening shot across the bow here to get you interested is you start with Vina. And and to sit down to watch the premiere screening and hear me first, it's like, okay, great. You started with me because that was your opening. Star Trek was your opening. And right. Vina. And I about fell over. It's like, okay, well, thank you. So thanks for doing that. And I've had three or four other people say, oh, my God, you were the first person talking. Like, I know. I'm an adult, elderly film historian from the 40s and 60s. Didn't you know that? But anyway, so thank you again, George, and thank you for taking me down these things and getting me to think about some angles and throwing out her biography. And I don't know, there's more to that story, too. I also didn't know she was sick with a fever the day they shot that, and I've kind of uncovered that, too, but which just adds to the magic of that scene.
Yeah, and as you learn about her, it's so not her, that role, which is real testimony to her commitment as an actress and what she could pull off. I mean, she's personally nothing like that. Was not really a sex kitten in her personal life or anything like that. She's a very different. In fact, I think by the 70s, and we go into this, she got very tired of that. It did not want to be known for that at all. But, you know, it was part of.
You mean Vina? You mean the green girl and that?
She didn't. I don't mean Vina in particular. I just mean the persona. Sexy blonde or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever color her hair and skin happened to be this week, she just didn't want to be known as a sex symbol anymore. I think it was kind of part of the deal in the 60s, and she could certainly commit to it if that's what the role required.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, she absolutely was the last person you'd expect if you just knew her as a person to play a role like that. And yet she did. And she did it brilliantly. And one of the other things we brought up in that interview, too, which I don't know if you'd ever really thought about before, Larry, but I got you to talk about it a little, was if you think about how many times the original series has been rerun around the world, pretty much on a daily basis since like 1970 or so. And all those first season episodes and the very last frame in the end credits is a picture of her pose with the Desilu logo over it before they went to Baylock or whatever his name was with Herb Solo's name. But before that, it was always her. So that image has been literally seen, even if you were just tuning in for the show after Star Trek and you came in a minute early. You know, people have seen that image. That image in particular, just that still of her with the Desilu logo over it, is really iconic. And in fact, what I discovered is it's not a still. It's probably 26 different stills, basically a second's worth of film trims that they probably were pulling off of some of the unused footage of that close-up. But it's actually the poses are slightly different and the little hairs on the gate are slightly different from from show to show.
Oh, okay. Now we all have to go back and watch.
I never paid attention to that. Interesting.
No, I actually went through, I was going on Netflix trying to find the best one, and I would go episode by episode. I realized, wow, these are not the same frame. These are actually one frame forward, two frames forward, but they're all different.
That's at the end of the episode too, so it's counting as a play. Someone at Netflix is going, man, this guy loves Star Trek.
But only the end credits. Only the end credits.
Netflix, CBS both love you there, George. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're saying that I can just sit. I have this mental image of young Bob Justman running around the little Desilu lot back and forth. Gene, I need some more trims for this week's credits. I need some.
Yeah.
Yep. Gene, I'm going to stand on your desk until you find me some more trims of Vena so I can stick them at the end. That's why they went to Baylock, really, because they ran out of Vena trims. No, I don't know. But now I can totally see that. There's times now when I think about even the modern shows, they're TV and they talk about how they're on little budgets and how they're pressed for time and all that, but they had staff. I mean, if Gene and Bob Justman and Gene Kuhn and whoever came after and Eddie Milkus, Greg Peters, if those guys had had 1/4 of the staff they had in the Berman era, I mean, just amazes me what their titles were and the things they were in charge of doing, you know. And you hear Bob Justman talk about, I made Gene write this script so we could go over and have Bill record the opening so we could put the titles together. You know, he's like Legoing and tinker toying the credits together on the optical. Or getting the one or two guys to do it. It just amazes me how they put that show together when they did and what it looks like still. So, and it all started with the cage. And one more thing that I just did a big, by the way, a little plug that I don't usually do. I just did a piece after I recovered from my deathbed. I finished the piece on the cage for the Titan magazine, which will come out later this year. And actually had some insights here from the doc and mentioned the documentary and Mark Cushman's new book and some other things. But maybe the most iconic thing about Vena being and her Green Girl, because Vena, we say Vena. I'm very guilty of saying Vena and meaning the Green Girl because, you know, Vena was the whole character, was when they went in and got their okay, which was, you know, historic and rare and amazing. When they got their okay for the second pilot try after the cage, and they're saying, oh, it's cerebral, go with a more down-to-earth story, you know, lose the woman, can you lose the vault? You know, all those things they went down the line was one of the, either Herb Solo's version or Mark Cushman's recounting of Herb Solo's version. It was like the last thing was like, and for God's sakes, Gene, no more green women and, you know, mini skirts falling off, okay? Please, can you like not throw that at us again? That really not flustered them. Well, probably flustered them too, but they were like, you know, good God, how are we going to put this on TV? I mean, you know, it was really pushing the envelope. So made Vena, the Green Girl, made an impression. It's like Star Trek got on the air despite that Green Girl thing that nobody could tear their eyes away from.
You know, it's a bit more audacious when you stop and think about it. And she talks about this too, that she claims in her book that she ran into Roddenberry in 1964. At one of the studios, and he sold her on the idea of playing this. And one of the things I think we paint the context pretty well in the documentary, she's the obvious choice. It's the most expensive pilot ever made up to that time. It's a big deal. Roddenberry's kind of a big deal in his career. There's a big gamble. Lucy gets behind it, and it's a role for a major guest star with five different performances, distinct performances. Who else are you going to get? I mean, she's the obvious choice. She's kind of like the go-to female guest star in 1964 in television. And then kind of it's, the you know, Roddenberry in your face to the network. Look what I did to Susan Oliver. I painted her green and put her up almost naked. I mean, it's kind of, she's more of the wholesome girl, you know? But again, I think you really, your hat's got to go after her. She would really commit to the performance. When she said, I'm going to do this, she would do it. And later, I think she, even to her detriment, where she knew she would regret some of the roles she took. But if she took it, she was going to show up and do it. You know, she wasn't one of those that had all the histrionics and the conditions and demands. And she just do it. She showed up to work.
Yeah. And she didn't really, as life went along, she didn't like look back with regret at the, not regret at the role, but go, oh God, you know, people, I did something else besides Star Trek. I mean, that didn't really,
oh no,
she didn't carry that around either. Right.
I think she was a little bit proud of it, you know, and she did show up at some conventions. There's evidence of that.
You've got your guy, 70s. your person you interviewed that had the famous picture with her at a con.
Yeah. You know, I got to tell you something, by the way. This is heartbreaking. I don't know if I told you this the other night, Larry, but James Darren was there at Vegas a few weeks ago, because I guess he was, I'm not sure which of the later series he had a role in.
DS9.
Deep Space Nine.
He was Victor. DS9. He was a lounge singer.
Okay. Which is perfect, because he was in the Gene Krupa story in 1959 with Susan Oliver and Sal Mineo. He played Sal Mineo's buddy. And Susan Oliver actually plays this wicked woman that lures Gene Krupa into trying Mary Jane, you know, and then all the trouble that it causes him. And so I went up and introduced myself to him at the convention, and I gave him a copy of the movie. You know what he said to me? He said, oh, is she here? He had no idea she was dead.
Hmm.
And she died in what year?
1990.
Yeah.
90, yeah.
And that's not that uncommon. A lot of people kind of missed it. It just kind of fits with everything else. They seem to have missed her career. People now never even aware that it existed, other than Vina. And they missed the fact that she died. I mean, that was as unpublicized as anything else about her.
Which is amazing, because, I mean, just go to IMDb, look up her name. The list is enormous. I mean, the amount of work that she did is enormous. And
it's ridiculous. It's
speaking of Star Trek, one thing that I wanted to ask you was what you found in terms of the place of Star Trek within her career, because she was working for a good decade before she did The Cage. So many credits and things you'll recognize if you go and you actually see the shows. The list of shows. So it wasn't like a case where someone gets a role on Star Trek and that became well known and then it helped propel them forward necessarily. Where does this spot on Star Trek fall within the context of her whole career?
Well, yeah, that's what I was saying before. She was already a huge star.
Yeah.
I mean, she was, when Susan Oliver was a guest star, they put an ad in TV Guide because that was a selling point that week. I mean, she was, you know, and the backstory is that we go into, she was a Warner Brothers contract player. She'd come from Broadway.
Movies.
And movies. Yeah, in movies. She had a 2-picture-a-year non-exclusive contract, which was a very generous contract in 57, 58. She broke the contract to do a play on Broadway. And they wanted her to come back to Hollywood and be in Up Periscope with James Garner. And Garner later called it some piece of crap Warner Brothers made him do when he was under contract. I think he gave it a 1 star out of 5. She wouldn't do it. And so she broke her contract. And the theory is that Jack Warner was pretty spiteful and he put a black ball out on her. And there was no way she was going to get much movie work after that, certainly not as a star. So she's this very talented actress who no longer really find much, if any, work in movies. Where's she going to go? Well, it just so happened at that time, historically, television was casting a huge shadow over the movie industry. So that's where she worked, and she worked often. So, yeah, she was a big name in television. She was, and that was a time when being a guest star meant a lot. Star Trek was somewhat unusual in that era compared to the shows she'd been doing before that, where if you were the guest star, it was really your show. It wasn't the cast show so much. It was a chance for you to really, especially the anthologies, like Twilight Zone or Alfred Hitchcock, where it's an entirely different cast every week. Mm-hmm. That's your show. But even some of them with a regular cast, they weren't necessarily very good actors. They were just there to kind of provide a framework, like Wagon Train. Perfect example. It's mainly provided as a framework for whoever the guest stars happen to be in whatever random story you tacked onto the Wagon Train that week. So yeah, she was a big deal. And that's why I say she was the obvious choice in 1964, because people would know who Susan Oliver was.
And just so everybody listening, because a lot of people may not be up with, if you're not familiar, we're talking about the, you know, pre-60s, pre-early 60s, when you said she was signed to Warner Brothers on her contract for two pictures a year deal for Warner's, we're talking about the era when all the studios signed actors to contracts, and you only appeared in that studio's shows unless they loaned you out, quote unquote, somewhere else. But the point was, it wasn't like some producer and director comes up and pops up and says, oh, hey, we want you in our movie and you agree to be in it. This was back when the studios owned the actors. And so the fact that she thumbed her nose at a studio contract, much less Jack Warner, who was the last of the movie moguls, that was a big, 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 big deal. She basically cut her own throat in the old Hollywood, which, you know, within 10 years had changed anyway. Again, but it's another sign of her being ahead of her. And people like gasped. I mean, not literally, but it's like, oh my God, she's, you know, well, she'll never work in this town again because she broke her contract. So we talk about this just so everybody gets it. This was at a time when actors worked by, even the big actors worked by contract to a studio, in particular to one studio. And you didn't run around. You didn't have control of your own career. You know, you were stuck at that studio. And if they abused you or if you got lost in the shuffle, the same thing kind of happened to Jeff Hunter and some of these other, you know, actors at the time. Mm-hmm. If you, you know, were an up and comer, you know, when D. Kelly was doing some of his B Westerns and stuff, he had the high, you know, you just did what they told you to do. And if you were a climber, then you tried to maneuver. And if you had box office clout, then you could, you know, you could politic for that. But if you were young and new and, you know, and or if some PR person or some producer didn't take a shine to you, you could get lost in the crowd. And not that she got lost in the crowd. She just decided she wanted to go do that other project. And that was just unheard of. So, yeah. So that's why he blackballed her, just out of spite, because you don't do that to Hollywood, which, you know, within 10 years it had changed. That all the old order had blown up. So.
Yeah, there was a question, and I don't know if you remember it, Larry, at the when we had that premiere screening in March, and someone asked if I thought she'd been born like at the wrong time, and mm-hmm. like they asked if she was born 10 years too early, and yeah, you could argue either she was born 10 years too early or 10 years too late, because if she'd been born 10 years earlier and hit Hollywood in the late 40s when movies are still king and television has very little impact, and she had that kind of a contract, I think she would have worked a lot more. Because the thing in her defense, she broke this contract, but they weren't putting her in movies for the majority of that 6 or 8 months she was on it. So she had the time to go to New York and get involved in a play, and she wasn't going to blow that opportunity just to go back into a bad movie for Warner Brothers. 10 years later, she'd gotten to Hollywood in the later 60s, I kind of think she could have had a career, something like a Faye Dunaway type career, maybe.
Yeah.
But the point was, you know, Faye Dunaway, she's hitting it around 10 years after Susan Oliver gets there. There's no studio system at that point. You don't need a contract with a studio. If anything, it's a hindrance. You know, this is now, producers come straight to you and say, we want you.
Yeah.
The problem with Susan was she by doing all that TV in the 60s, she kind of shot herself in the foot for when the studio system collapsed, she was so known for TV, it was kind of, she no longer had any clout at the box office, which is a shame because she was quite good.
So beyond that, about, well, what was it, 1978, that's when she directed? Was it an episode of MASH, the first thing that she directed?
Well, it's a little more convoluted than that, and we didn't necessarily go into that much detail in the movie, but I know that she was interested in directing even in the early 60s.
And there weren't many female directors at the time, right?
No. It was a very forward-thinking thing. And we kind of cover that in the movie a little bit, that all these guys talking about, even Nancy Malone, who was another one of that era, mm-hmm. Naked City.
And end of her career years, worked on Star Trek.
Yeah, as a director. Right, she directed a couple of Voyagers. Yeah. But she said, it never even occurred to any of us that a woman could direct. We never saw women direct. The only one at that time in the 60s was Ida Lupino, was still writing some of the clout of her movie years where she directed some movies. But other than that, there really were none. Susan finally got into the AFI Directing Workshop for Women, the inaugural class of that in 74, did a short of her own. Reshot it on her own in 78 based on the one she'd done for the AFI. It wasn't till 82 that she got her MASH. So even though she'd started doing this in earnest and shooting stuff in 74, it took another 8 years until she was able to get her MASH. And I think what happened there, if you look at MASH, it ran 11 seasons, 5 women directed. Elaine May did too in 77, I think. And Elaine May was famous for having worked with Mike Nichols, big name in improv. She had done a lot of directing on Mary Hartman, when that first came out. So that got her a foot in the door. And then she did a lot of the other women sitcoms like Rhoda and Mary Tyler Moore. And so they let her do two in 76 or 7. But then it wasn't till the 80s, the last couple seasons, the other 4 women that directed a MASH were. And I got to believe, this is just pure speculation, that Alan Alda had something to do with that. Mm-hmm. He had always been kind of a forward thinker. And Susan was one of that 4. And she got one that was very centered around, it was the one time Nurse Kelly Nakahara, or whatever her name, mm-hmm. Nakahara, I think, got a chance to have a major part. And it was really an episode built around her, but it was a woman's story. So they let her do it. And that went very well and was a well-received episode. And in the following year, by hook or crook, she managed to get on to direct a Trapper John M.D. This was about the 97th episode, 5 seasons in, first woman that ever directed on that show. And only one other would direct 2 years later, I think. So 7 seasons, 151 episodes, 2 women directors. And that crew apparently had her for lunch. And there's also speculation, and I've heard it's even more than speculation, depending on who you talk to, that Pernell Roberts also made it very hard for her. But they were just a very hostile, very male, very white crew. They just did not want women. It was Don Brinkley and Frank Glicksman's old, is the same guys they'd used on Medical Center. In fact, one of the actors we had, and who was a fairly major actor on that, he said, "I always thought this is exactly the same show they did 10 years ago, Medical Center, young doctor, old doctor." And same white actors and same white crew and all guys. You know, it's not a very innovative show, but they certainly were not ready for women at that time directing. Mm-hmm, yeah. And they treated her pretty badly. And unfortunately, I think that followed her, because all it took was it was not a very good episode. I don't think it did well in the ratings. So all of a sudden, it's Susan Oliver's fault that episode didn't do well. And I've looked at the episode. It's like any other bad episode of Trapper John. It's a stupid script. I mean, it's really a dumb plot line. And I one of the guys Charles Siebert's the guy we interviewed, and he played Dr. Riverside. He was the comic relief on that show. And he went on, he directed 7 episodes while he was on the show. It was his first chance to direct. He went on to direct quite a bit of Xena Warrior Princess and some Hercules in the 90s. So he did quite a bit of directing eventually. And he said, he's like, that's absolutely ludicrous. A show like that, especially 5 seasons in, there's really nothing the director can do to change anything. That's the same crew. It's the same actors. You know, you're a traffic cop. You're there for 10 days. Yep. You yell action and cut. You know, that's it. So I don't buy that.
So do you feel like part of the, you mentioned up front that people, her career is almost forgotten. And like I said, if you look at the list of everything, it's astonishing how much stuff she did, but yet people don't remember it. Is the story of her career kind of stepping on toes or being in the wrong place at the wrong time, like with the movie contract and going to do the play and then being blamed for this episode, which really, like you said, the director's not going to do anything to make the episode better in the first place?
Yeah, she has a lot of bad breaks, some of which she played a direct role in, some of which mm-hmm. she didn't necessarily play any role mm-hmm. in. But yeah, it seemed like everything that could go wrong kind of did. you know, in one way or another. We also, I mean, there's a whole thing we haven't talked about at all, which was another fascinating thing that attracted me to the story. She was a record-setting female aviator.
I was going
to
say, all of her life outside entertainment.
And she did this very high-profile, it was supposed to, it started out high-profile thing in 67 where she flew across the Atlantic, a solo flight, single-engine prop plane, and she was supposed to go to Moscow. And she made it from Canada to Greenland to Iceland to Scotland to Copenhagen, all part of the planned route. And then the Soviets decided they weren't going to let her fly into Russia. So the press dubbed it a failure. And there's these headlines we have in there, the failed flight. And they just ignored it. To the extent that they covered it, they just called it the failed flight, and it was like it never happened.
Even though nothing failed about the flight,
stuff she faced.
The failure was that the Kremlin wouldn't let her fly into their airspace.
Yeah, well, I think it tells you a lot about how the press treated women.
Lady pilots, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it just... But it's another example of just she couldn't catch a break, ever. I joke her Love Boat episode in 1981 with Paul Burt from Naked City, and she's the one that leaves the episode at the end of the episode. She hasn't found love. She leaves the boat alone, which sadly echoed her life, too. She never did end up
married. The only one on Love Boat who never got anybody, never hooked up.
Right. So it's just, I don't know. It ends up, part of it is it's just a really fascinating and unusual life, and a woman that, very much a square peg that didn't fit in a round hole when it was expected that she would. It's just so many strange aspects to it. And just to finish the directing thread, she was trying the last couple of years of her life to convince Paramount to let her direct a Next Generation.
Oh, really?
And what she basically got was girls don't direct Star Trek. I think the official answer was she lacked the special effects qualifications that she would need, and that was the end of it as far as Paramount was concerned. No, we'll work with you or anything. Because then Nancy Malone says in my documentary, I don't know anything about special effects, and she did two Voyagers. Mm-hmm. I think it's just a convenient excuse. If you look at the record, two women directed that show too. One of them is Gabrielle Beaumont. Mm-hmm. Who had a very strong track record from the BBC in the 70s. In fact, she's one of the other four besides Susan that directed a MASH in the early 80s. And then Gates McFadden directed one of the last. And Gates McFadden told me last summer, I wasn't able to get a camera in front of her, unfortunately, but she said, look, I'm the only one of that cast that came in with prior directing experience. I have a strong theatrical background. I directed on stage. I've been asking since season one. And they finally give me one of the last episodes after they've let Stewart, Frakes, and Burton direct multiple episodes. And none of those guys had ever directed when that show started. I think there's a serious bias towards male directors.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I was about to ask you which seasons of TNG were those, but then with your story about Gates, that's all the way to the end. So
yeah.
Larry, what happened with... So on Voyager, we have female directors. With DS9, how many female directors do you remember, if there were many? Was it like towards the end of TNG, is that when finally the studio kind of shifted?
No, I mean the two Nancy and back in when we did a women's issue on Communicator and we interviewed Nancy Malone and Gabrielle Beaumont, and at that time that was the only two. That was in the early aughts. Now Roxanne wound up getting to direct later,
right?
By the time of I'm trying to think if she did a Voyager, she didn't direct until Enterprise, but no, it was still a, I don't want to say it was, but if it was rare, it wasn't resisted. And if they came from the show, like Roxanne wound up directing a lot. Now she's like LeVar and like Robin McNeil. She directs all over the place and for a lot of shows, and she's made a career of it post acting. And you know, and there's women all over the place directing now, and there's a million channels with shows for them to direct on. But at the time, I think that was the only women to direct on Trek. But it wasn't. It wasn't a cause. It wasn't a thing then. Mm-hmm. Even though Gates kind of suffered in silence. You know, I don't think Marina ever cared about directing. Kate never. You know, she was a lead. Nana and Terry and None of them on Enterprise.
No one from the cast of DS9 or Enterprise, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. And so after Kate didn't, you would think, okay, well, the leads would have clout and might want to. And, you know, Avery and Patrick and Shatner did the movie. So, yeah, not to hold Enterprise up as, I mean, Star Trek up as failing its liberal, its progressive future human bent here.
But it seems like maybe there would have been sort of an
The early part, when Susan, talking about what George is talking about, Susan's career and her life, because I should let George should talk about, without spoilerizing it too much, her end years, and they were kind of, you know, not tragicomic. They were sad. She had health issues toward the end, but when she was still in her peak, where she was able to get up and go and get it done, that would have been the very, very first earliest years of Next Gen, the first couple of years. And so when she's talking about that, I mean, the production atmosphere on Next Gen was a lot different earlier than it was later. I mean, part of that was before Michael was there, before Jerry was there. Jerry was really working on the cast. I don't think she was so much trying to work on, you know, giving opportunities for women in the crew so much. But they did. I mean, Mary Howard went from being a first AD up to being, you know, the number one producer under Rick. I mean, she went down that path, and she had the personality and the skill set for it. And she certainly, you know, Adele, gone blank on her last name. But there were a lot of women through the crew and through the upper echelons, the office positions and all that. So it wasn't like they weren't adept at doing that. And yeah, Mary Howard's kind of a shining example right there. So anyway, you know, it was kind of a mixed bag. But as far as Susan wanting to direct and all that, the first couple of years were probably, with some of the personalities involved and people involved, it probably was more of an old boy network then, because so much changed in the middle year. Not just because Michael Piller came, but so much shook up then. And then the show took off and was huge. And then the spinoff started happening. And, you know, and all that happened. So it was easier, I think, by the time Nancy Malone and Gabriel Beaumont. But then again, how many women directors were out in the pool, George?
Right.
You know, like, I don't know. How many were there to step in, to come in and apply? And it may have been used as an excuse to slap down Susan, but that was still a thing. I mean, it took a special kind of skill set to direct on a Star Trek, because now it's like every medical show and every cop show has CGI showing how the bullet goes in the body and how the virus spreads. You know, there's CG everywhere. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be a space battle. So, and setting up live effect shots. So, and just dealing with that as you direct and knowing enough to either know it yourself, or you drag your Dan Currier, your Rob Legato in to help you set it up.
Why would that be a gender thing in the first place, though? I mean, what would be the reason that a female director wouldn't know this?
Well, a lot of male directors didn't know it. I mean, there was a thing. Yeah. Now, if they're using it, the point was, if you were a director that didn't have that skill set, if you were open to leaning on the help on staff, and Star Trek had all those, like I was just going through, Rob and Dan Curry and Gary Hutzel and Rod and B. Moore, they were there to help a director. In fact, they would rather the director, I mean, they love collaborating with the director. They love not being shut away and have the director egotistically just get it, or not egotistically, just not care and get it done. And, you know, the old fix it in post thing. Well, now, great. Now I've got to take what he shot and I've got to come in here and fix it a million different ways and all that. You know, that kind of resentment would come up. So they loved being brought in to help shoot. And if it was used as an excuse to keep her from directing, that could well be, but it didn't have to be. There were also a lot of male directors who didn't necessarily have that skill, because a lot of shows at the time did. Like I said, now with CG being all over the place, you can, you know, fan films are churning out with CG. So
right.
TV directors now, it's not that big a deal, or they're just more skilled to begin with. But the pool of women was so much smaller to start with, the feeder pool then versus later.
Well, One of the really astute comments that one of Susan Oliver's friends made in the documentary, and he was a guy that she wrote with in her later years, but he had come up, he was an African-American and had come up under one of the showrunners or one of the major guys on Police Woman in the mid-70s. But then he found almost no opportunity after that because they didn't want a black guy on the set, basically, for lack of a better way of putting it. He said, you know, as liberal as Hollywood is reputed to be, it's a business, and it's not nearly as liberal as it seems. And that business decision is, well, we've used this pool of guys for 20 years, and they always work out fine. I'm not trying to blaze new social causes here. I'm trying to come in on budget and schedule. So there's not really a lot of incentive, and wasn't, and to some extent maybe still isn't, to kind of blaze new trails. So to open up opportunity for people.
Mm-hmm.
And the director's one of those high-profile positions like that,
mm-hmm.
you know? And even now, I mean, what is it, that center down in San Diego, San Diego State University, Professor Martha Lauzon, they issue that annual report card on the industry. And it's still 25, I think at best, 25% women and minorities. It's 75% white guys are still directing TV overall in Hollywood, even now. That's a heck of a lot different than back in the 80s, but it's still overwhelmingly one way.
Yeah.
It just is. So, and what is it, 5 or 9% maybe last year it got up to on feature films?
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. Mm. I mean, everyone can say, oh, yeah, well, look at Catherine Bigelow. Look at Jodie Foster. Okay, give me 10 more. Because you can certainly do 10 more on the guys list easily.
Sure.
So, it's just... It's one of the director in particular is one of the last ones. I don't know what's so different about that one. I mean, I guess it's really telling when someone like Nancy Malone says, you know, it just never even occurred to me that a woman could direct because we never saw one.
And you know? She's a woman director.
Yeah. But this is she's a woman director 20 years later.
Right.
But, and she got lucky. I mean, we didn't put it in the documentary, but she told me that, you know, a producer she was working with at ABC in the early 70s said to her as she was approaching 40, what are you going to do when your acting career is over? And she was taken aback. She said it never occurred to her acting career was going to be over. But as a woman approaching 40, her acting career was going to be over. It's not like the guys who can just keep working and working and working.
Well, that's even worse than women directors is the women actors. Right. And that's changing too. You know.
Right. I mean, I just
as they claw it. Yeah.
Well, and just also the kind, I mean, I would never watch Desperate Housewives, but hey, more power to you, because it doesn't mean you're done at 40 or 50, mm-hmm. you know, and Orange is the New Black is a wonderful show, and it's women of all ages and sizes and shit. It doesn't matter what you look like, but it's can you act, which is what it should be.
Right.
But the point is, Nancy, she was kind of realized that this guy was warning her about something, and he took her under his wing and helped her get into production. And she became, by the mid-70s, the first female VP of television production in Hollywood, I believe, as this was at Fox. And she was able to parlay that position of power over the next 5 years into a situation where she slowly started to direct. She also went through the AFI program, but she had something besides that in her hip pocket. She had that clout. So that's how she did it. And there were very few of them that were able to pull that off at that time. So...
Just for the record, let me just jump in here since I was so vague about it before. DS9, there's no Gates was the only woman on TNG. Gabrielle Beaumont directed one on DS9. She's the only female. She did In Purgatory Shadow. She did a Voyager. She did Blink of an Eye on Voyager. Nancy Malone did two on Voyager. And I said Roxanne didn't do any Voyagers, but that hung with me wrong. Roxanne did start. She was like the first of the actor women to go through the program. Gates wanted to, and they wouldn't, you know, Gates may have lost out by losing her year and being on the outs, that her track or whatever. whoever's internal clock, Rick and David Livingston, the guys, she may have lost a couple of years there, you know, on the thing. But Roxanne directed Riddles, and then she directed Workforce Part 2. And then she did a whole lot on Enterprise, the one that was ripoff of the movie Dawn, or her episode was called Dawn, Enemy Mine. I say it was ripoff. That was, she did the Andorian incident too, which was a big action.
Well, she did Vox Sola, which was a challenging episode to direct.
Right.
There's actually a whole behind the scenes with her on the Blu-rays of Vox Sola, which was really fascinating.
Yeah. And Dead Stop, which is another kind of oddball one.
Yep. Well, she's the computer voice in Dead Stop as well, of the station. Well, with Susan Oliver here, George, we've gone through her career acting, television, movies, directing here, attempts to direct anyway. So in the end with the documentary, what's your ultimate goal in telling the story? You know, what do you want fans to take away from the experience of watching this?
Well, I guess first and foremost, I just want people to realize that this woman existed and did all these things, and that there was, you know, and again, it's funny. That's one of the things I've been taken with at the conventions, the Star Trek conventions. They are really interested in what these actors did. A lot of them have their tables set up, and it's all the other. Even Rod was there at the creation table, and he's got his dad's episodes of The Lieutenant and all the other things that he did. You know, that there is this excitement for the other things these people did. And here's someone that did just a ridiculous amount of other things. And I just, it's almost like I keep saying this at Q&As. It's that thing about if a tree falls in the forest and no one was there to hear it, did it make a sound? Well, hell yes, it made a sound. It made a tremendous sound. And it'd be nice if people got a chance to experience that sound 50 years after the fact, because it did exist. It really happened. And maybe there's some further things we can take out of this about where women are coming from in the past, where they are now, where they need to get to. I mean, in terms of how they're treated, especially by this industry, by the entertainment industry. So all of those things.
On one hand, what you said a while ago about if I was aware of her at the time too, and all the, like, I was a rerun baby. So I'm watching Star Trek in the 70s and here comes Vina. And it's just that, like a lot of these characters, I mean, like William Wyndham on the Doomsday Machine, I knew him from The Farmer's Daughter, which is amazing to say that now. And I know him from even from The Thurber Show, from My World and Welcome to It, that won the Emmy and was canceled. It was one of the early martyr shows. You know, it was a great show. It was too good for TV. So, you know, some of the Trek guest stars you knew, and then certainly by, you know, Next Generation on, you knew, or you saw them later on, or it's like watching Perry Mason, or it's like watching Gunsmoke. It's like, oh, look, it's, you know, or here's Rawhide, and it's the first appearance of Clint Eastwood or whatever. And here's Dennis Hopper on The Lieutenant, you know, the show that was banned and cost Gene Roddenberry the series there. But it's like, you just had this vague notion that you'd seen her around, even though I was a little kid. And it really did. It made you stop and go, whoa. And to know not just, oh, well, she was a familiar face, but like George said, she was a chameleon. And to go back, and again, a lot of these shows, they're not on even the rerun channels. They're not on DVD. They're not really popular. But I mean, I remember what a big thing Peyton Place was. And she was not a regular, but she was a featured guest star. It was a big thing when she was on for two or three months, George? And
four months. Yeah.
And then she got killed off. And it was a big shocking, it wasn't quite a JR moment, but it was a big shock to a lot of the show. And, you know, it was Peyton Place was the nighttime soaper that was on two or three nights a week. And she did that right about the time she came over and did The Cage, right? That was 64?
And that was 2 years after, actually.
Oh.
It was 66.
Because it was still black and white.
They were doing black and white still in 66 on their
and it
show.
Was ABC, so that kind of they were cheaper than
they're still trying to catch up.
Yeah, but the point is that she was just, she kind of blended in, and I was a little on the younger end to know that, like we were all talking, but it was just great to know that this iconic person that you knew from her, any Star Trek fan knows her, and like we said, so many mundane audience members know her. And that's part of my mantra in Soapbox, is there is so much history in general, much less our pop culture beloved entertainment industry history, and so many stories and so many aspects that these people are disappearing. It's like the old silent movies that are disappearing, you know, that we've lost because we didn't preserve them. It's the same thing with the people and the memories and the stories. and the ways of life, and not just the work that's on film, but the sociology and the social issues of the work and Hollywood. And like George said, it's supposed to be so liberal, and how it was still a place to go work, and how there was a lot of crap that reflected the times was still there, and how we may be even shocked to think that way about a lot of it. And all of those things are little niches of value that everybody's got great stories. I mean, I'm all for recording all the stories of anybody we can find. I mean, I wish you could get funding to just sit down and start recording everybody's story.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
And not just actors and directors and writers, but the grips and the lighting guys and everybody who stood around. I mean, one of the best things ever was when they did Trials and Tribulations on DS9, I think I mentioned this on the show, one of the grips actually worked at Desilu in 67 when they did the original Tribbles. And he was there for both shows. Mm-hmm. And I just fell over. I was like, why haven't I talked to you already? And he was about to retire. So I was glad we sat down and talked a little bit. But there's, you know, for every one like that you stumble across, and George had some great stories like that with the people he found, we lose them. And George, tell them how many you've had just die just since you talked to him. You've had people pass away.
Yeah, three died, Nancy Malone being one of the three, and I think Susan's manager, he may even be dead by now. I talked to him 3 days ago when he said, wow, I'm on my deathbed.
Gosh.
Yeah, and that was another sense of urgency I had in just doing this, is because I realized, you know, if Susan Oliver were alive, she'd be 82 right now. So all her contemporaries, people both older and younger than her, but not by much, they're not going to be with us that much longer. Some of them were already gone. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's why, yeah, I love projects like this, just like Larry was saying, and the point you make there, that we're quickly, time is slipping away to talk to all these people. And so there is a sense of urgency, I think, for everyone involved in documentaries or just any, just interviewing and getting this information down. Well, George, to find out all the details of her life, of course, people need to watch the documentary, The Green Girl. So if people want to see this, I haven't seen it because I'm in Japan. I know it's available on DVD. I know you do screenings as well. Where can people go to find out more, and how can they actually see the documentary?
Well, your best bet right now is get the DVD, which you can get through our website, which is thegreengirlmovie.com. All one word, thegreengirlmovie.com. And there's a link. You can both see the trailer there, and you can see picture, a link to buy the DVD. And we ship the DVD worldwide. It's not region encoded. And in theory, it should play on any DVD player. It'll certainly play on any computer. In the United States, there have been some one-off screenings, but I don't know that there are going to be that many more of those. You can go to gather.us if you want to find out more about that. That's gather.us. And just search for The Green Girl there. Those are the two main information conduits. And check out our Facebook page, which you can find via the website. We put a lot of pictures of Susan up there. And and we're on Twitter, Green Girl Movie.
Are you working on any potential deals in the future to maybe have it on Netflix, for example?
Yeah, we're supposedly coming out towards the end of the year on I don't know exactly which digital. You make a deal with an aggregator. And iTunes is one of the ones that's probably going to be on. Mm-hmm. Netflix, you never know. Netflix, no one knows exactly what their criteria are, but the aggregator will try, and we'll find out if we get on or not. Okay. I'm hopeful that we will.
Oh, George, let me talk. I got a guy at Netflix that
really?
I met with. Yeah, it's who I sold my Star Trek series to. So, sorry.
Oh, wait, you're
could
all right.
Not,
wait a minute now.
I could not resist
Star Trek
that.
Does CBS Paramount know about this?
I know. Larry, I know who you're talking about. I think his name is Starfleet Intelligence, right?
Yes, his name is Starfleet Intelligence.
Yeah.
Oh, George, I'll tell you. Old joke, bad story about me being misquoted. Yeah, and all the power in the universe that I have in my little finger.
Oh, that's right. I remember when that hit the news. That was just several months ago.
Got 8,000 hits on my website, but
that. Yeah. I remember that. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know about Netflix, but I think there will be iTunes, Amazon Instant, some other opportunities like that at the end of the year. Unfortunately, it takes them a long time to get this ball rolling. So in the meantime, the DVD is the best bet.
Yeah. But another good reason to be on your Facebook, because if you're on Facebook, on the page, then when you have news about the streaming services, Netflix or whatever, then you'll know. People will know.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah. Yeah,
absolutely.
Excellent. Well, George, thanks so much for joining us tonight to talk about this. It's been really, really interesting, and I hope the audience enjoyed it as well. I know we have a lot of listeners who love hearing about the background of people who work on the show, actors and actresses. And it's interesting that you guys mentioned the lieutenant as well, because as Larry knows, our show commentary, Trek Stars, did a whole series about things like the lieutenant and all these kind of lost shows that have come out in the past. So I think people will enjoy it.
Well, thank you. It was a real pleasure being here.
Well, Larry, I'm glad you suggested that George could come by and we could talk about The Green Girl, because as I mentioned up front, it's something I've been wanting to do for a while, and I think it was really interesting.
Yeah, that was great at Vegas. I was able to help get George connected with getting a lot of interviews done and getting some exposure, because it's as I'm finding out, it's not easy being an independent producer and being an independent documentary producer. But I'm, you know, that's one of my soapboxes, is get history, get Star Trek history, get history in general, get your local fandom history recorded, get, you know, things are going to slip by and assets are going to go away and people are throwing their trash away and people are dying and people are losing their memories are getting fuzzy. So if something is cool and worth knowing, and, you know, our perceptions of things change. So something that you know, sometimes we're the worst judge of what's important, because somebody comes along later on and goes, oh my God, this is so cool. And you go, what? Right. It's just my lawnmower and my old tire swing. Yes, but that's a whole fad now. I mean, you know, whatever it is. So, and if anything, Star Trek connected is that, and the glory years of TV and pop culture. And so I was glad. So it's been good to help him get the word out there. And I told him, we just talked last week, and I said, you know, the whole thing about trying to break the glass ceiling is an important part of Susan's story. And the things that she did do, even if she wasn't able to, I mean, when she was a plane racer, and all of that. And I said, there are a lot of avenues of people who would be fascinated to see her as a pioneer. And again, not let that story go untold.
Definitely. Well, this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this past week. We've been talking about all kinds of subjects. So we have other fascinating things for you on the rest of our shows. And here's a quick look at those.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
See, they say that Spock's not a funny guy. But
that's
this,
really funny.
This shows, you know, even more than his command ability, it shows that even in the most dire of situations, he still has a sense of humor.
Earl Grey.
Any other points on Transfigurations?
Come on, no. Let's go to the next one. Let's go to the next one.
Episode 26. The best of both worlds. Part 1.
The Orb.
If it was anybody else, I would be questioning the ethics of it much more. But because of the relationship that Sloane and Bashir have, I almost kind of expect that Sloane would look down on Bashir if he wasn't doing something like this.
To the journey!
It's just a good old action story. It's easy to follow. And yeah, okay, granted, yeah, Janeway's got the rifle in her hand and she's going around, but she's shooting bugs.
That could be scary, though. There's a lot of dark lights, a lot of jump scares where you open up a door and then the monster comes at your face.
The Ready Room.
Well, keep in mind, espionage and spy, they have trouble with those two words in Romulan, so maybe that's why it comes across as stilted and contributes to the world's slowest disarmament and fight in the history of anything.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
It doesn't temper anything that the attempt is valiant. No matter how noble the knight is who fights for this king, he's fighting for a corrupt king.
Maybe they're not trying to be valiant. Maybe the next people who come in will try to be defiant.
Yes.
Literary Treks.
And I think Kira makes a great point. We need closure. And this is a great way for us to close the book on everything that happened to us for the last 50, almost 60 years. Mm-hmm.
Continuing mission.
What are we going to do for the man trap? What are we going to do? Because it's all about a salt creature, and a lot of it's on the planet. What do we do? And I literally just blurted out to Ashley. I was like, what if it was all about the plant?
Melodic Treks.
No, it's got nothing to do with the actual episode. It's just the music. But I think it's really funny that, yeah, I've changed my opinion of him. So I'll choose music from the episode that most people say is complete rubbish.
Well, the first 2 minutes of that episode are fine. They're the same as any other episode, really, aren't they?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond, as we demonstrated in today's show. And you can find them everywhere you get your podcasts. We're all over the place. Just search for Trek.fm and the name of the show you want to listen to, and you'll find us there. Grab the master feed that has every episode of every show that we do and some other special content in there. And Larry, I understand that if people can't get enough of Larry Nemechek,
oh my God,
there's also a special feed of just you now.
That's what I hear. Yes, my people were really insistent on that. I'm sorry they gave you such a bad time, kind of pistol whipped you around there, Chris. It's like, give Larry his own channel page or nothing at all. And it happened. So, you know, I apologize for that in advance, but, you know, business is business. So, yeah. I don't know where that came from.
So that's something that we're starting to do now, is to create some collections, because we have, I've lost count, but I know it's probably 1,100 plus episodes here on the network. And it's hard to find the content now, because some of it's been, it's almost 4 years old. And we're creating some new collections where we have specific topics, you know, all of our commentaries in one feed. I'm going to be doing one of all of our discussion of alien races, for example. And one of the first ones we did is a collection of all the episodes from all across the network that feature Larry. Mm-hmm. So you can find that iTunes, Stitcher.
When we get to 47, we have to stop. But until then, it'll be fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll do a new feed. So we'll have 47 in each feed.
Till we have 47 feeds of 47. Yeah.
That's right.
Scary.
All right. So speaking of podcasts and places that you can get them, we have gotten some more iTunes reviews. I'd like to share a couple of those with you today. We have one here from ETNSKVL, who left us 5 stars and said, "The Ready Room provides a very welcome in-depth review of all things Trek, whether relating Trek to 24, which of course would be Mike and Max, I'm sure, on commentary Trek Stars, or talking at length about if wishes were horses, there is always something to talk about in the Ready Room." Yes, we actually talked about if wishes were horses for longer than the episode, Larry. We didn't have to stretch our discussion out when it was 9 minutes short, like they did on DS9.
And you wouldn't have to, and you couldn't blame me for it either. You stretched it just fine without me.
I did.
I'm very proud of
it. Actually, I think relating Trek to 24, that's probably Mike and Drew on Standard Orbit, I think, who did that.
Oh, okay.
So there's also a review from Lady Bears Fan.
Huh.
And she left us, I assume it's a lady who's a Bears fan.
I was going to say Chicago, maybe?
Left us 5 stars, probably, yeah. Left us 5 stars. Said, "Entertaining and informative. Informative Star Trek news and entertaining topics and guests. I listen at work and in the car, and it helps make the day more enjoyable, as I don't really have any friends that enjoy Star Trek as much as I do, so this is a good place to get a Star Trek fix and enjoy all the Star Trek series and movies that are covered."
That's great, but we got to get her to Vegas, and or get her to a con near her. Get her on the tour.
Definitely.
We'll get her some friends that enjoy Star Trek as much as she does.
Plenty of people who enjoy Star Trek as much as you do there, Lady Bears fan. So thank you for these reviews and for everyone else. Please take a moment and review the show. It helps other fans find the Ready Room as they're searching iTunes. You can also review all the other shows you listen to on the network and the master feed. That's one people don't often think about reviewing, but that's a great place to let us know your thoughts as well.
You should call your master feed Vol, you know, just for a nickname.
Vol.
Yeah. Master feeders.
Vol.
Yeah.
Well, because of the way that iTunes works, the way it searches title tags, it would have to be Vol: a Star Trek podcast's master feed. That way people can find it.
Oh, God, I'm just sorry. I just thought Master Feed was...
I can see the cover art right now.
I knew you could. I thought I'd just spin your little brain spinning. Yep, there you go. Just put it on my bill.
Also, one more thing to plug here at the end of the show. I would like to remind everyone about Patreon, which we talked about in the news segment.
Yes,
and that's a great way for you to support us, because we really do need your support to keep the network going and make sure that we can keep bringing you our podcasts and our Star Trek discussion every week. Just go to patreon.com/trekfm. Everything is spelled out there for you on the page, what our current goals are, what the contribution levels are, and the perks that you get in exchange for those. You can donate any amount you want, but we have broken it out into some specific levels as well. So check that out, patreon.com/trekfm, and we really appreciate you supporting us there. If you'd like to share your feedback on today's show, there are many ways you can do that. Just go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to me by email. You can also find us on social media. Our username on Twitter is trekfm, facebook.com/trekfm, G+. We have a community there. We have forums at trek.fm/forums. And also, we have voicemail. If you go to the show page and look on the left sidebar, you'll see the tool for that. Or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm, and you can use the microphone on your web camera or your smartphone or your tablet to record a message for us, and you can upload it to us right there from that page. And we'd love to hear from you by voice, and we can play some of those here on the show. So, Larry, when you're not, you know, seeing if you can line up maybe 8 more conventions this month to attend, where can people find you?
Well, good old LarryNemechek.com is kind of the home base. And, of course, it's Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Facebook and just at Larry Nemechek on Twitter. And there's Twitter and Facebook for The Con of Wrath, our documentary that we're actually getting back to. And I just put a post up. I've had people responding about being transcribers to help us get on with our interviews. So if that's something that's simple for a screen credit you might like to do and hear actually what some of the people we've interviewed have said firsthand, that's kind of a cool little insight. And the Trekland trunk, which I haven't mentioned in ages because I had to shut it down because it was just too much busyness during the crazy time, but we're about to start.
Have you reopened the trunk?
We have reopened the trunk. This week is going to be some pieces brought out, some set plans and scripts, and I've got to get my stupid office, or it's kind of like looking it's looking the worst for wear the last 3 or 4 months of madness. So it's getting back up, and now that I'm out of my deathbed, I may actually get on with life and get going again. Again, I say this all the time. I have so many billion video interviews and vid chats to put on my blog and the treklandblog.com and talk. And I haven't talked about any of this. So I'm looking forward to getting on and doing all that. And of course, very proud of the help you gave me with our Volume 3 of Trekland on speaker. So I haven't even begun to yet to really get that out to the world. So thank you again for mentioning it last week, and hope everybody
Of course. Go to LarryNemechek.com, look in the left sidebar.
Right, in the news section.
You'll see a link right there.
And then on top of all that, I do have a project that I've hinted around about, Enterprise in Space, that we're going to have hopefully here in the next 2 or 3 weeks. People will be hearing about it. The big launch. It's very exciting because it's not just a Star Trek thing. It's a whole science fiction, science fact, inspiring science kids and their teachers and space development and an actual space mission. And more than that, I won't say, aside from there's still a primal Facebook page, but we're going to have our big splash launch, a soft launch, and then the big main one here in the next 2 or 3 weeks. So I hope everybody is primed and ready to hear that when it comes out. We're not even asking for a chunk of money. We just want a million. We want that same effect. We want a million people giving a little bit, and we'll have some donors in with us, and it's just very exciting, and a lot of people involved, and a lot of people working on it a long time before I got involved with it, and that's going to be a big thing going forward this year, along with all these other crazy projects I've gotten involved with.
So that sounds exciting.
Yeah, so I'm gonna try to live in balance here and go see some England and tell everybody about Trekland and show off some of these great people I've been talking to lately, and including you.
Well, thank you. Well, good luck trying to live in balance.
Yeah, I know.
It's very, very difficult.
It's a small town over in San Bernardino County. Sure. I'm going to go over there and visit a little bit.
Balance. Yeah, Balance, California.
Balance, California.
Now we know where Larry's moving. All right. Well, if you would like to find me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C, and Brian with a Y. I'm also on Facebook. Facebook.com/CBrianJones. Feel free to hit me up there. And I have my website, CBrianJones.com. I'm not selling any cool CDs or anything like that on my website, but you can go see what I do ramble on about over there. And then elsewhere on the network, I do a lot of different shows. There's The Orb, Literary Treks, Continuing Mission, Matterstream, Hyperchannel. There's Warp 5 and the official Star Trek Axanar podcast, which I co-host with Alec Peters. And check those out and find out what else I'm talking about in the world of Star Trek. And then one more thing before we let you go. We'd like to thank Audible for their support of today's show.
Oh, yeah.
If you go to audibletrial.com/trekfm, you can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying the service. You're going to love it. I've been a customer for 14 years, so I promise you're going to love Audible. And when you try them out, it really helps us keep the Ready Room coming to you every single week. So go grab a free book. I recommend The Physics of Star Trek by Lawrence Krauss. It's one that I read back in the day in hardcover, and I have the audio version now as well. It's kind of outdated technologically, but it's also interesting to read and see how much things have changed that even Dr. Krauss himself didn't think would change that much, probably, just within a couple of decades. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we really thank Audible for their support, the show, and the network. Well, Larry, I got to let you go. I've got to go practice my dance routine, because some insider information here, I'm not supposed to reveal this, but I know that they finished the script for the next Star Trek film. It's actually a remake of The Cage, and I'm planning to audition for the role of Vina.
It puts the A in alternate universe. That's what it's doing. Right. Yeah. Okay, Chris. Well, I think, it's time to stick a killer bridge in it, because the Ready Room is done.